Welcome back to the program. It was Oscar Wilde who said that the cynic knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. For too long, we've been very good at measuring out the price of everything, but very bad at meeting out the meaning of value. What that value proposition means and how it can be measured, in fact celebrated, truly must become the currency of our interconnected global society. Our guest today, Dov Seidman, argues that our world is being dramatically reshaped, that the old rules no longer apply, and that in the 21st century, it is no longer just what you do that matters, but how you do it. Dov Seidman's professional career has been focused on how companies and their people can operate in both a principled and a profitable way. He is the founder and CEO of LRN and has worked with hundreds of companies to help them create and sustain values. He's been named one of the top 60 global thinkers of the last decade by Economic Times. He's a Harvard Law School graduate who also has degrees from UCLA and Oxford University. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome Dov Seidman here to the program today to talk about his work, how we do anything means everything. Dov Seidman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Great to have you here. One of the things you talk about is sort of these paradigms that we have gone through historically, both in the workplace and in personal relationships, that we've gone from kind of command and control, this kind of blind obedience of the industrial age, to the more informed acquiescence which we went through, the kind of carrot and stick approach, to where we are today, this whole idea of values-based kind of self-governing operation. When did we make this shift, and why did it take us so long?
Oh, you're starting with the deepest question of all, the why. I think the final catalytic force that did it is the way the world got so connected. We went from connected to... And when we're connected, we're all publishers and readers. We upload things online, and we can take anything, download anything. But when we became interconnected, the world became social. We started relating to each other in new ways and to people halfway across the world. I enjoy eating steak, but I'm now in a global supply chain and asked to collaborate with people for whom a cow is a sacred being and ought never to be turned into steak. We send emails to people around the world. We can't tell what culture they're from or what language they speak, yet we're thrust together technologically faster than we have developed human frameworks to get along and collaborate and work together. We've since gone from interconnected to interdependent. We are seeing examples every day of how we are rising and unfortunately falling together. And the final straw is that the individual has never been so powerful. We've democratized, if you will, the power to be a force for good or harm. One banker at his desk today in London can lose $2 billion for his bank, wipe out bonuses for all of his colleagues, and introduce added risk into the financial markets. At the same time, one vegetable vendor in Tunisia and a few friends armed with cell phone cameras and access to Facebook can spark a revolution towards freedom throughout the Middle East. And even though how we do what we do, our behavior, if you will, has always mattered, it seems to matter now more than ever and in ways it never did before, and the individual can consequentially impact so many others so far away in ways he or she could not before. So I think that's really what made how matter so much. I should also add that this kind of interconnectivity has made what we do more like a commodity. We're being reverse engineered and copied in 6 days or 6 months, but certainly much faster than 6 years. And we used to win in business and in life through what we made, our products we sold, being better, faster, cheaper, the service we provided. That just keeps us in the game today. And the source of competitive advantage continues to shift away from what we do, to how we are, how we relate to others, how we behave, and how, as leaders, we lead and operate large institutions.
As you talk about, really the commodity today is character, that you talk about that we've entered this era of behavior.
Yes. Well, if we are an interdependent world and we're all in a crowded theater, you can't and you ought not to shout fire. At the same time, the reason to get our hows right and to take behavior seriously is not just to have a bulwark or protection from lurching side to side, greed to fear, crisis to crisis. It also becomes your propellant and your guide, because instead of avoiding exposure in this transparent world and hunkering down and trying to act as though you have nothing to hide. What I'm really arguing and trying to bring to life is this idea that we ought to lean into this world, understand how it operates, and turn its conditions to our advantage. I'll tell you a story. At the University of Michigan Health Systems, doctors found themselves being sued in this world increasingly for medical malpractice, like other providers of health care. They decided, let's get back to fundamentals. Who are we? What values do we hold dear? And we're about patient health, and they decided that every time we harm a patient, let's genuinely apologize. Well, the command and control types, the lawyers in this case, said, you better not apologize. That's an admission of vulnerability and weakness and can be held against you in a court of law. The doctor said, but it's the right thing to do. And they wrestled over this, and eventually the doctors got their way, and they started to genuinely apologize. They had another value, truth. So they only apologized when, in truth, they felt they acted wrongly, but they fought when they believed they acted rightly. Their lawsuits and payouts went down by 50%. They then created a culture in their hospital in Michigan that became just much more comfortable talking about what's working and what's not. So they were able to improve the provision of their medical services and increase medical outcomes. Other hospitals have followed this trend, and now 37 states have passed legislation that apologies can't be held against you in the court of law. And this started by saying, let's not just do it because we can, let's do it right because we should, and they've made a difference in the offensive side of their business.
What have you seen in terms of the ability of older organizations, and the doctors are a good example of this, to make this shift, to internalize these new ideas about the value of character and the value of behavior, and do you find that it comes easier to the younger generation?
It comes much, well, people who've grown up in command and control, fighting for the formal title, the bigger job so that they can have leverage, they have to transform. I mean, if you look at the last six winners of the Super Bowl, we're in football season mm-hmm. right now, you'll notice that the last six winners are coached by non-command and control coaches. They do not scream at their players, if you will. Now, one of them is Tom Coughlin. He used to be very dictatorial. And he used to fine players if they came early to meetings, but not early enough, and he would put buckets on the field, and if they didn't throw up into the buckets, he would assume they didn't practice enough. Tiki Barber went on TV and called out his coach for being a distant dictatorial figure. He changed his ways. He transformed and started to talk to players about life outside the field, extended much more trust to them to make decisions about how hard and what kind of practice to have. And he did that the year they beat New England last time, 4 years ago, and they might do it again. The other five coaches are much younger and never were in positions to scream at their players in the same way. But that's quite a trend. If you look at companies, I'll point out to you that Chevron is now the human energy company. Cisco is the human network.
Right.
Dow is the human element. Deere is... human flourishing. Ally Bank says we speak human. Delta Airlines is saying 1 ounce of humanity is stronger than 500 tons of steel. What's going on here that one company after another is proclaiming to the world, let's have a relationship in a dimension that transcends how we make money and our product, but who we are and how we behave and treat you. Now, I know what you're thinking. Isn't that just their marketing department? And it probably is, but the marketing department is a harbinger of where the world is going, and the companies that really get this are investing resources and leadership attention to turn these humanistic proclamations into corporate practices, leadership, and individual behaviors that are really winning in the marketplace and keeping the company stable, but more importantly, allowing it to thrive.
From a historical perspective, have we ever seen a period before where there has been this concerted effort to connect morality to both work and life?
Well, no, and a short answer. You know, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and I tend to look at society through the lens of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered, why is it that the movie Wall Street crescendoed with this critique? Greed is good. Oliver Stone has been on record saying that that was a criticism of how we're doing business, especially the financial community. And how is it that bankers took greed is good as a clarion call to go out there and well be greedy as a compliment? Well, there was a movie a few years before The Godfather, and we all know the famous scene when Tessio is being carted out off to be executed for the attempted murder of Michael Corleone, and he has the temerity to stop and say, "Please tell Michael I always liked him. It's not personal. It's just business." Now, if it's just business, if we can create a separate sphere that it's just business, or a locker room like in Penn State where it's just football, or in Washington where it's just politics, if we can create these separate spheres and continue to go to funerals and hear that he was a jerk at work but a loving husband and a caring father but a ruthless negotiator, if business is separate from society, then greed is good. Let's become too big to fail. Just get it done. I don't care how. These are actually winning, rational strategies. But Occupy Wall Street and the connectivity of the world is really all about how personal everything has become because we've become so interconnected. And all those strategies no longer apply to the world because you can no longer create this separation. The moral philosopher David Hume said that the moral imagination diminishes with distance. The smaller the world becomes, there's no space to take our morality and let it escape to. We have to reawaken it because we're all connected. So I think that we're really starting to divest from large ideas that shaped our behavior upon which we scaled our institutions, that business is somehow separate, that man is just rational, so we should just use carrots and sticks to coerce and motivate man, that the corporation's only responsibility is to shareholders and therefore it should only focus on becoming profitable, et cetera, et cetera. We are going from just do it to just do it right, from becoming too big to fail when we see these implosions and bailouts that are required, going from too big to fail to let's become too principled or sustainable to fail. And we are finally starting to understand that people don't want to be treated as just quasi-robots, carrots and sticks to extract performance out of them. People want happiness, they want meaning, and we need to start to connect with them in life and in the workplace around things that matter. What would inspire someone to unleash their commitment and dedication and innovate and go beyond and collaborate and speak up in meetings and really represent their company honorably and fairly on social networks? Because we've never asked for so much humanity out of our workers. We used to ask for hard work, productivity, speed, and efficiency. Now we want ideas and creativity and collaboration with diverse people. We are asking for people to communicate on behalf of the company, not just corporate communications, but we're all tweeting and on Facebook, etc. The more humanity we ask from people, the more we need to relate to them in human ways. So I think it's a real renaissance and quite a shift.
And one of the things you talk about is there's this tendency, historically, to kind of manage that which we can measure. And
yes,
the part of what you're talking about also requires that we find new metrics and new ways to measure how.
I think that's the final thing we need to focus on. You know, we manage what we measure, but we also need to come to grips with the fact that what we measure is a choice. What we measure is a window into what we value and into our values. Now, what do we measure? At the national level, we measure GDP, how much stimulus, how much debt ceiling. At the corporate level, it's how much profits, how much revenue, how much market share. Even the new economy, we launch a website, it's how many page views and how many click-throughs. If we keep measuring how much, we're going to keep focusing on how much. But the more horizontal, interconnected the world gets, and the more how becomes the new currency, how we engender trust, how we engender loyalty, how we relate to society, the environment and community, and our people and our customers, the more we need to invent metrics for how. And we've done that. We actually did an independent study of over 5,000 people working in small to large companies. And we came up with four archetypes where we look at the forces that shape corporate and individual leadership behavior. These forces are governance, the laws, the policies, the controls, the approvals, the org structure, the culture, how things really happen around this place, the values, the principles, the stories, the tradition of the company. And then leadership. Is it command and control? Is it connect and collaborate? Is it transparent? Is it need to know? And we look at how these forces come together, and there are four archetypes. One of them is anarchy. We all know what anarchy looks like. The other is blind obedience, rigid hierarchies, command and control, top down, do what the boss says. The predominant archetype is informed acquiescence. We inform people as what's expected of them. We're very much following rules, pursuing success, and using not just sticks, but lots of motivation and carrots and stock options, etc. And the fourth archetype is what I call self-governance, where people are doing the right thing because not to do the right thing is not just a failure to comply with a legal minimum or a policy. It's a betrayal of values and oneself. These companies are really not just about success, but significance, making a difference in the world, etc. I've got some good news and bad news for you. The bad news is that only 3% of organizations are fully self-governing. So 97% have work to do. But the reason to go on this journey is if you are self-governing, you have half the misconduct, so you have half of the kinds of behaviors you don't want. You have 5 times the receptivity to new ideas, 3 times the level of innovation, 3 times the level of employee loyalty, 3 times the level of customer satisfaction, and all of these turn out to be leading indicators of financial performance and competitive advantage. So you have to measure how, but there's a reason to start measuring how, because if you can get your hows right at scale, you will start to get sustainable advantage in the marketplace.
Of course, there's also the whole business of trust and getting the employees to buy into this and to believe enough in the trust to take the risks that result in the innovation.
Only 9% of organizations have been able to foster high trust environments. If I trust you, who has the virtue, according to Aristotle at least, of trust? You for being trustworthy or me for trusting you? Because when I trust you, I'm giving you the power in doing that to do right by me or let me down. Now, we've all grown up in the tradition of trust and verify. We always ask, who can we trust? Who's trustworthy? Can we trust this employee? Well, let's not pay them their expenses until they get 2 signatures from 2 superiors. Can we trust this vendor, this supplier, our customers, et cetera, et cetera? And we keep looking for trust when if we give it away, we will create that loyalty. And it turns out that the rock band Radiohead trusted its fans to pay whatever they thought the music was worth, and they sold more albums in that instance than the 4 albums put together when they put a price on it. Ritz-Carlton is now trusting its people up to $2,000 a day to do whatever they think is right to solve a customer problem. They're creating loyalty with their people and their customers. And in Indonesia, they have corruption at pretty high levels. Do you know how they're fighting corruption? Instead of more controls and more police, they now have surpassed 10,000 honesty cafes where citizens, and now schoolboys and girls because they've put these in schools, are taking food off the shelves. And instead of going to a cashier where the change is transacted, they put money in a jar and they make their own change because they are trusting people to start to learn early in life these habits of honesty and probity.
I mean, this is the story of the donut vendor that you tell.
Well, that's where it all started. A few years back, I discovered a donut vendor. He outsold his competitor, Kitty Corner, 3-1. And his only innovation, because the donut was fresh, but so was his competitor, they were equally priced, and if not, one competitor could cross the street, buy his donut, go home, reverse engineer it, and copy it, etc. He put a tray of loose change, and he trusted his customers to make their own change. And they really appreciated that gesture and repaid it with loyalty, and they started lining up every morning, and they had a relationship with him because he was not preoccupied with the transaction. He stood there and really was about the experience, and he let them deal with money on their own. Neuroscientists have done research. It turns out that when people believe that their trust is extended to them, oxytocin is released in their brain, and they actually, whatever makes them leery or weary of you subsides, and they're more likely to reciprocate their trust and create virtuous cycles of trust. I've created a formula for this. Everybody wants progress in their life or in their business. We all know that to have progress, you need innovation. You need to do something differently or better than before. We all know that to innovate, someone needs to take a risk. I got to speak up in a meeting at the risk that my boss is going to think I'm a bozo. I might need to spend some money at the risk that I don't get return. And when do people take risk? When there's high trust. So think of it as a trip. If you can engender high trust, T, people will take rational risk. That will result in innovation, which will result in progress, trip. And it's really sad that we're at a time right now where so many people are out of work. And the people who could be creating jobs for their brothers and sisters and cousins are the people in the job. if they could go on this trip, if they could really start to take the risks to innovate and generate growth from within, employee engagement scores have never been lower. 7 out of 10 employees today are not engaged on the job, and 2 out of those 7 are actively disengaged, meaning they're engaged in sabotage and subversion. Imagine if those 7 people out of 10 were popping out of bed and running to work and were inspired to go on this trip and innovate, the kind of growth and dynamism we could start to inject back into our society and economy.
Talk about this in the context of so many of the crises we face today and what has resulted from that in this kind of anger that we see in so many places at institutions, and the way that anger has turned into not so much a desire to move forward, but a longing for a simpler, more structured, in some ways, a more command and control time.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned crises. There's actually an ironic dimension to these crises that causes me to be optimistic. We used to have crises largely every 10 to 20 years. Our boom and bust cycles were 10 to 20 years apart. So we didn't have an incentive to change fundamentally. If you're going to have a crisis every 10 years, when it happens, you hunker down, you show some resilience, some people go out of business, there's some bankruptcies, you clamor for some new regulation, but pretty soon things start to get better and you enjoy 10 years of growth and prosperity. So we used to ask for, let's reset the system, let's reform it, let's reboot it. If you're having crisis every 10 days, every 10 weeks certainly, you know, imagine the CEO that used to have a 5-year plan, and then they went to a 1-year budget. And then they have a 1-year budget, and there's a Greek bond crisis, and a tsunami, and a Gulf oil spill, et cetera, et cetera. If you're lurching crisis to crisis every 10 days or every 10 weeks, you finally have an incentive to rethink things, not just reform the system, but to rethink fundamentals. How do we do things differently? How do we create resiliency and adaptability and innovation? And how do we keep our feet on our ground in this uncertain, crazy world? So ironically, I'm sitting with CEOs who are asking questions they never would ask before. Recently, a CEO asked me the following question. He said to me, you know, it took them 17 days to toss out Mubarak, and he had a military. How long would it take my consumers or employees to toss me out of here? And when CEOs are asking those questions, when they watch companies like Netflix seem so invincible because they're adding so many subscribers, and then to watch 800,000 subscribers in a 48-hour period self-organize on the net and book the company and crash the stock, when they're seeing consumers tell Bank of America after raising their price $5 for a debit card, we're not going to have it, and force Bank of America to reverse course and issue an apology, that's quite a new world. And I'd say to you that Occupy Wall Street and all these movements out there, what they have in common, there's a lot of anger, and you've used the word anger. I think it's deeper than anger. I think it's anguish. Not anger, but anguish. I have an education. I have student debt. I'm not just 21, recently graduated college. I'm now 25, and I still don't have a job. I think there's a sense that we're not on path. It's not clear my life will be better than my parents. And I think what you're seeing around the world is a lot of force to tear things down. It could be a dictatorship. It could be a corporate system that's not working and getting in our way. But we need to be really thoughtful about this. When you tear something down, you create freedom from. You create space, freedom from a dictator, freedom from a micromanaging boss, freedom from anything standing in your way. But just because you've created freedom from does not mean you've created freedom to innovate, collaborate, live a meaningful life. Freedom, too, requires values and frameworks and principles. And I think what we're seeing right now is you're seeing a lot of tearing down. Companies are flattening. There's less hierarchy. There's less command and control in all aspects of the world. So we're creating this spatial freedom, freedom from. The hard work is to create freedom, too, to start to scale values and principles and new ways of building more sustainable lives and institutions.
And is there a danger in that as we move towards more transparency and more trust, and that begins to scale out to a larger and larger framework in all of our institutions, that there will be more and more people that are unworthy of that trust and create potential failures down the road?
Of course there's a danger, but what choice do we have? I mean, look, we need regulated, uniform behavior. We all believe in governance. The question is, do we want to be governed from the outside with a power figure using carrots and sticks and rules, or from the inside, what I call self-governance? And I think we failed to learn the lesson from one of our greatest institutions of all, NASA. In 1986, when the Challenger tragically blew up and fell out of the sky, we were mortified, and we went into NASA through the lens of traditional governance. What controls were in place? What compliance was in place? What were the processes? And we said, this can't happen again, and we turned NASA into a perfect compliance and governed organization. We really invested a lot of time and energy and money in that. And then in 2003, the Columbia tragically blew up. And we went into NASA, and lo and behold, we discovered that NASA indeed was a perfect organization. It had every process and governance control you could imagine. But the culture had so much fear. The human infrastructure trumped the controls. There was so much fear that junior engineers did not want to come forward and say, if this sponge were to break away from the wing, it could bring down the Challenger. Others said they were arrogance. If I'd come forward, the senior people wouldn't listen to me. And I think we're starting to realize that the human infrastructure, if it's strong or weak, will always be more determining of whatever processes and controls you put in place. So I don't know what alternative we have but to take our deepest values and principles and find ways to scale them and create cultures where people hold each other accountable.
Dov Seidman, the book is How, Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. Dov, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's a real pleasure. All the best to you.
Thank you.